this is talking with John Bolton at Jodrell Bank on 13th August 76. Could you tell me a little bit about your educational background and then how you got into radio work, please?
Yes, I was born in Sheffield, and I went to school at the drama school in Sheffield, and then I did a physics degree at Trinity College, Cambridge. That was at the beginning of the war.
Graduating in what year?
42. And from there I went into the Navy as a scientific officer, worked on airborne radar, and finally saw the last year of the war. I was in the Pacific with the Pacific Fleet on the base carrier there, more or less dealing with all problems in electronics. Right. And I stayed in Australia after the war.
But this was the Royal Navy?
This was the Royal Navy, right. Yes. And joined the Radio Physics Laboratory. And,
Now, I think it's you and someone else that are answered similar advertisements. Is this the right story? You and Paul?
Oh, Paul Wilde, yes.
Could you tell me that?
Well, I was in Australia. Paul was also in the Pacific Fleet. He was radar officer on King George V battleship. And when I got out of the Navy, I really had no intention of doing any work for some months. And I went through the Australian, British Navy transferred me to the Australian Navy, and I went through Australian demobilization, you see. And one of the questions on a form I had to fill in, it said, do you want assistance from employment? So just for the fun of it, I put a tick in that column. And
right.
I saw a man an hour later who was looking for bricklayers and painters, and he said, well, you know, I'm not really the right man to see. And he gave me the name of the man who was then Director of Higher Appointments in New South Wales. I went to see him that afternoon, and he rang up the university's commission, and they put me in touch with Taffy Bowen, of course, who had been at TRE in England, as one of the early people at
right.
TRE.
And I have talked to him.
Yes, and I went and saw Taffy, and Taffy offered me a job, you see. So, being the public service, I have to advertise a vacancy, and at that time, Australian vacancies and scientific field were advertised worldwide, and Paul saw the advertisement in Nature and applied for it, you see.
I see.
I remember Taffy coming into the room where I was working and saying, after I started working, said, you wouldn't have to know this man, would you? And I said, no, and I asked a little about his background. Well, Paul was at Cambridge at the same time, but we were a year different and different colleges. It must be a good time. That's Paul's offer the job, and of course, 10 years later, we were virtually running the layouts.
Right, right. So you also mentioned to me that you and Paul were both born in Sheffield.
Yes, within a few hundred yards of each other, but his parents left Sheffield when he was quite small.
I see.
And, of course, mine remained in Sheffield.
Now, was Paul offered a job in answer to that advertisement?
Oh, yes.
Two positions were made for the one.
Two positions were made for the one advertisement.
And when you took this job, what did you think you were getting into, or did you just know that it was something to do with radio?
Well, at the time, Taffy Bowen was really only interested in the sun. And I, in fact, started working on the sun. I built equipment to determine polarization of solar bursts. D.F. Martin, who was a really known atmospheric physicist working at Astronomer, had done some theoretical work and was suggested that we might work together.
Right. So you knew definitely you were getting into radio astronomy, or it wasn't called that then?
No, it wasn't called that. That was called solar noise. And, the equipment we built, we had an old radar experimental station on the cliff edge on the south arm of Sydney Harbour, and we made our observations from there. And to a certain extent, rather than work on the sun, which seemed pretty dull, Stanley and I attempted to break up the background of galactic noise into discrete sources by utilizing the interferometer.
Now, knowing about Hayes' discovery of this one source, you said that the galactic background might be composed of many more of these. Is that the idea?
Yes, actually, Hayes' work was rather independent. Hayes' work was published while we were working on the Sun, and Pawsey had made an attempt to detect the scintillations which Hayes saw, the fluctuations in the Cygnus source, but
right.
Actually didn't get any results. He couldn't duplicate Hayes' work, and our work to a large extent was quite independent of Hayes. We started a systematic search pointing relatively low-directional antenna over the siege and just recording what came in, the background galactic noise, and looking for signs of interference pattern.
Why do you think that Pawsey did not get scintillations? Was it because of the much higher zenith angle? Closer to the zenith?
I really don't know, because I didn't see Pawsey's records, but of course the source might well not have been scintillating when he looked at it.
Yeah.
As it happened, the Cygnus source, the NGC 5128, the Centaurus source, and the Cygnus source were really discovered on the same night. The Centaurus source we found before the Cygnus source, but our signal-to-noise ratio was so poor at the time that the observations were of practically no value, and as soon as we got the stronger one, we sort of spent some months following it up, trying to locate its position and everything like that.
But
before we went back to the routine survey, in fact, in our historical list, the Crab Nebula is shown as the second which we discovered.
Right. But I'm a little confused. Did you know about Hayes' discovery of a discrete source?
Yes, we knew about Hayes' discovery of a discrete source.
Before you found Cygnus with your instruments?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, when we found Cygnus, we related it to Hayes' discovery. I think that's the...
I see what you're saying. Okay.
I mean, as far as we were concerned...
You weren't certain that it really was a discrete thing.
Pawsey had got a negative result on trying to repeat Hayes' observations.
I see what you're saying. Very interesting. Okay.
I mean, I would give, as far as I'm concerned, Hay gets the credit for discovering discrete sources.
Yeah. But I'm interested in
because I mean, historically, it was the first indication.
Right.
But our work on Cygnus was really quite independent of Hay, and as I say, it followed a negative by Pawsey.
Right. Which was never published. This negative.
Which was never published.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
Now, as we later learned in our space aerial experiments, the scintillations were scintillations and not real fluctuations of the source.
Right.
And particularly with SLEE, I did a lot of work on the diurnal and annual variation of these things, and it's quite conceivable that at the time Pawsey made his observations of the source, in fact, was not scintillating.
Right. Before we go on anymore with your sky survey for sources, let me go back to the business about the Sun. You said your goal was to measure some polarization in the solar burst, I gather. And there was indeed, within a couple of weeks in Nature, three different groups reported polarization, Ryland, von Berg, and Appleton and Hay, and the Australian group. I can't quite remember who the authors were. I don't think you were one of them, though.
No. We, in fact... Stanley and I did very little work on the Sun. We did, though, get the first of the Type 2 outbursts. We had, and this was published under Pawsey,
Payne-Scott,
Yabsley, and Bolton.
Right.
Ruby and Don Yabsley had been working on the trying to measure time differences between the what we now know as Type 3 bursts.
Right. Right.
And Stanley and I had a very happy accident in seeing the first of the Type 2 outbursts with the very long delays to us between our various frequencies. And
that was what was mentioned here in the summary of that article, that some type delays as much as a few minutes are
That's right.
Right.
And that, of course, indirectly led to the spectrograph on which Wyatt started.
So. Right. But he wasn't working in that group at that time?
No, no. He was actually working in the test room at Radio Physics.
I see. Well, I'll have to talk with him.
Electronics.
I have to talk with him about that, because he doesn't surface in terms of publications.
No. No, well, they spent a long time building the spectrograph.
Right, yeah. Which paid off, of course.
Which paid off.
Yeah. Okay. So you joined CSIRO in 46, would it be then?
Yeah, I'll be around August or September 46.
And spent some time then working on the solar work, but then decided that it would be more interesting to look for these discrete sources. And you say that Centaurus and Cygnus were the first ones that...
Centaurus, we had a very poor record of Centaurus and a moderately good record of Cygnus. Were in fact obtained on the same night.
Right. And
the crab followed about 3 months later. And
this was using the C-Cliff interferometer
technique.
Let me ask about that. It's my impression that this was a direct outgrowth of techniques of radar that had been used on board ships. Is this correct?
Well, ships and shore base.
And were any of the people that got involved in radio astronomy later involved in this development during the war?
Well, at one stage during the war, I operated a night fighter squadron and a chain home low station on the 1st or 4th. And, of course, the sea interference pattern was a nuisance to us.
Right. So you knew about it from practical experience.
And from shipboard experience. The sea interferometer was nothing new. We had a short training burst at Portsmouth before we went out into the service, and there's a Canadian, you probably know the Canadian radio astronomer, Carm Costain.
Yes, I've talked about
him. Well, his elder brother, Cease Costain, who was at the Hertzberg Lab, and I were on the same course at Portsmouth.
I see.
We designed an analog computer to, in fact, determine the height of an aircraft. Using the sea interferometer for timing the intervals between passing through successive lobes.
But were any of the other people like Pawsey or Bowen involved in the development of the sea interferometer as a military technique? And then they just said, well, let's just take this over. Or was it only your
population? No. I mean, it was a well-known phenomenon.
I mean,
we happened to utilize it in Australia because...
Well, that's the next question.
We had some clips. I mean, if we'd been at Blackpool or something like that, we probably wouldn't have done.
And you use it also, I suppose, because of its advantages, namely you only need one receiver. You don't have to worry about...
Yes, it has a nice gain in sensitivity for a small antenna. I mean, you don't have to divide signals between impedances and so on, so you get four times the gain of the antenna, effectively.
Right. And the procedures for correcting for refraction and the C state and all these sort of things, were you able to take those over directly from available literature, or did you have to develop new?
No, refraction was one of our problems. I mean, attempting to locate the source, what we could determine were the times of the minima above the minima of the pattern. And from the geometry, wavelength, height above sea, and so on, you could compute the actual ones. And then you had to know the refraction, and this was really a problem. You could get a reasonably accurate time of crossing of the horizon, but then to get another coordinate was very difficult, because it was not just the refraction, it was a differential refraction between a relatively small series of fringes. And although we did publish a position of Cygnus quite early on in the piece, I wanted to go to New Zealand. We had the choice of going to New Zealand or going to Perth to get a west coast, where I'd reasoned that it was possible both to solve the refraction problem and solve the source position. And New Zealand was closer than going to Perth, so we set off for New Zealand. I remember Taffy asking me what I really thought of the positions of my sources, and I said, well, they're as best as I can do at the moment, but I'd like to be the first to correct them. And indeed, the corrections were absolutely massive when they came in. And one of these things resulted from the fact that we'd taken a combined ionospheric refraction correction, which had been worked out on the wrong theory by Kiersey.
Mm-hmm.
And this relied for its experimental data on some of Pawsey and Payne-Scott's observations of the sun.
Yeah.
And it was hopelessly in error. And our early radio source positions used these corrections, which were hopelessly in error. And the reason why they were hopelessly in error was not realized for several years, in that the optical positions of sunspots had been adopted as the radio positions of the sunspots. And all the spots that had been studied were on one limb of the sun.
Yes, and so the radio burst was way off.
The radio burst, of course, being way off, gave a totally false low-angle refraction correction.
Right.
And, of course, as soon as we got to New Zealand, well, we first made observations from the east coast, and not being at much too different latitude, the times of rising of the sources were fairly well in accord with what we expected. But of course, once we got to the west coast, the real big errors were found, and we started looking for sources half an hour after they'd set. And that's the other thing we found from New Zealand, was the Earth was curved.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did the west coast help you in the refraction problem? You said I could see the position problem. But...
Well, let us suppose that we make the technique, what we had was a line on the horizon which corresponded to the time of rising of the source. Now, don't forget, we're working at very low frequencies. The atmosphere and the ionosphere behave extremely irregularly. And so the times of minima of sources could scatter by as much as 5 minutes on an individual night. Mm-hmm. By taking a lot of observations, you can get down to, say, an error of 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a band along the horizon which might have been a quarter of a degree wide. Now, where you put it in azimuth on the horizon depended on the timing to successive altitudes. And if your refraction curve was way out, then it put the declination way out. However, by going to a west coast, you had a time of setting, which was only within 1 minute. And this gave you, without any further corrections, an error box which was only a quarter of a degree in extent.
Right.
And then knowing the approximate declination from that, or a pretty good approximation to the declination, you could go back and say what the form of the refraction curve had to be. It put certain limits on its form, and therefore tightened up this 1 minute time of rising. I mean, you couldn't have something absolutely ridiculous in the way of a refraction correction. As it happened, the refraction correction in the mean came out to be just the same as optical. That is to say, the ionosphere pushed you one way and the other by enormous amounts at times. So our stay in New Zealand was just a matter of beating down statistics. And,
well, except now I remember in Pawsey, McCready, Pawsey, and Payne-Scott, you know, the solar paper, the time of rising of the sun was well after the first fringes received on the interferometer, which would indicate to me that the refraction was much greater at radio wavelengths than optical.
Ah, yes. But the position of the radio source is very different from the position of the optical source. That's the point.
Oh, I see. So that...
That was the... That,
oh, I see.
You say the source
even
in the
there,
sun.
You're right. Back to what you said
way
before.
It is out.
Yeah. So that's... So is, I mean, I haven't looked into this. So it is true that at the horizon, then optical and radio refraction are
right,
the same.
Right, correct.
Okay.
But you see, they had all their spots on one side of the sun.
And in fact, it was on the high side. No, the low.
The low.
Let's see, which would be... you see the radio before you see the sun.
That's,
so
that's
on the high
right.
Side.
And on the high side of
right,
the sun.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was where that you see, that was the thing which threw us. Now, of course, a couple of years later, when we started doing, I think Payne-Scott and Little started doing positions of radio emission from spots. Of course, this was very obvious.
Right. Okay. Now, let me get the sequence right. Having published these six sources, all of which turned out to be
in the wrong constellation.
Only a couple of them are in the wrong constellation.
Yes.
Notably Virgo, of course.
Yeah, well, you'll notice that it depends critically on the declination.
Coma Berenices. Mm. But they all turned out to be real sources, though. Is that not right? Two of them you didn't give names to, but they were Hydra A and IC443, as I got it here. And they were off by 5 to 10 degrees because of this error thing. But nevertheless, that was a big step forward from the one thing that Hay had. And then after publishing this, you decided, well, you've got to get these things down right, and you went to New Zealand to fix it up. And then was it also as a result of those observations that you came out with a very accurate position for the Cygnus A?
Well, we came out with a very good position for the Crab. That was, I think, we still didn't get a good position for Cygnus.
I think
we were still several minutes of arc off, but at least we weren't degrees.
Well, in the publishing, the Crab comes later, but you're saying that in actuality, you had a Crab position earlier than you had a good Crab position earlier than you had a good Cygnus.
Well, in the publishing order, I think the identification of the Crab M87 and NGC-5128.
Right. Was July 49.
Yes.
But the Cygnus position to 7 arc minutes was February 48.
That was before we went to New Zealand.
I see.
And that position, I think, is not very good.
And if you look at it carefully, find the declination is a degree out.
It's exactly 1 degree. Let's see, hold it now. Gee, I don't have my table here. Well, you probably know the positions by heart, having looked at it so much.
Is this? Yeah, I think we're a long way out.
That's right. It's coming back to me now. The importance of this paper is that you got the angular size to be less than something like 10 arc minutes.
Yes, that position is quite a long way out.
That's the point.
Because in fact, we never did publish our New Zealand position in Cygnus, because by that time we were sort of talking backwards and forwards to Ryle. Cygnus was a difficult object, never got far above the horizon and so on.
Right.
But our next significant step was the identification of the Crab and the two radio galaxies.
Okay, before we get on to that, you brought up an interesting point, namely, what did you know about what was going on at Cambridge and or Jodrell Bank?
Palsy went to Cambridge with essentially the results of our first paper on Cygnus, and told Ryle at the time, and Ryle left his solar interferometer running overnight.
I see.
And of course immediately got Cygnus and Cassiopeia.
Right. And of course Cassiopeia you couldn't get because it's too far north. And so you think that was really a strong motivation that shifted Ryle from his early solar work to...
Yeah, that was the motivation.
...the radio sources. Now, but in general though, you pretty much knew what... there was correspondence going on as to what...
Yes, Ryle and I had a fairly complete exchange of letters, and we had our problems with the sea interferometer, he had his problems with the east-west interferometer, and so on.
Well, since you brought that point up, the direct comparison, you stuck with the sea interferometer till early 50s, sometime, is that correct?
Mm.
And What was it that you think that eventually laid the sea interferometer to rest as a useful astronomical instrument?
Around about 51, we tried variants of the sea interferometer, two antennas as a cross north-south interferometer, crossing an azimuth interferometer with a sea interferometer.
Two antennas on the same cliff.
Yes, on the same cliff. Mainly to get rid of the background, the large background. And Stanley and I decided we couldn't get any further without, we had built we built an 80-foot steerable, sort of semi-steerable hole in the ground type instrument to investigate, working at much higher frequencies where we'd be away from the effects of ionospheric scintillations and refraction effects and so on. Mm-hmm. And Stanley had spent about a year developing equipment for 400 megahertz, where we reckoned there would be absolutely no problem this way.
What year is this roughly now?
Oh, that would be 51. Mm-hmm. And, well, our problems with the C interferometer, A, we wanted a much bigger instrument because many of the sources were obviously confused. And secondly, we wanted to go to a higher frequency. So we built this test antenna. It was the one, incidentally, which decided that the galactic center was the galactic center.
Oh, yes, that's right.
McGee and I.
Right.
And we had a proposal in to build a standing paraboloid, somewhat like Krauss's system, fed by a dipole stack, in which we could move the position of the dipole across the focal plane to steer the beam. The beam would have been, I think, about 4 degrees in the vertical plane by a degree in the horizontal plane. And then we would take the whole structure down and turn it through another 10 degrees.
Oh, yes.
We had done tests to show the system would work, but at the same time, Bernie Mills came up with the idea of the cross, and Taffy Bowen was sort of backing me and Stanley, and Pawsey was backing Mills. Pawsey was the head of the radio astronomy group, and so we lost out, and I went to work in cloud physics.
This was about 52 now.
For 3 years, yeah. Yes.
Well, okay. Well, maybe this would be a good place to end. We can resume sometime, but I do have still a couple more questions about your identifications. Well, could you just tell me how that happened? So you have these six sources. You've got positions which are accurate to plus or minus typically 8 to 10 arc minutes or so. Mm. And then what did you do?
Well, the results of the New Zealand observations took me something like 3 months to reduce manually. Mm. Terribly laborious. We were at the end of a long power line in New Zealand and at the end of a very long cable on that power line. In fact, the lights used to go out at times. And, the clocks ran fast and slow.
Right.
And just correcting timing of the records and everything like that was a tremendously laborious business. But at the end of 3 months, I concentrated on the crab because we had the best records from both east and west coast.
Yeah, you concentrated on Taurus A, didn't you?
I concentrated on Taurus A, yes.
Right.
And of course, at the end of it, we came out with something that was around 6 minutes of arc, with an error circle of about 6 minutes of arc. And sitting in that was the Crab Nebula.
But now, how did you do this? Just look in a book for the position of the crab, or did you actually collaborate with someone with a photograph? And
Norton Star Atlas.
I see. Okay.
And then I rang up Harley Wood at the Sydney Observatory and said, Harley, what can you tell me about the crab? And, during the sort of long nights of observing 18 months from Dover Heights, I'd read a great deal of the astronomical journal, the astrophysical journal,
right.
And so on, learned a lot of astronomy.
Right.
And I think Minkowski had just published a paper on the crab, and although I hadn't read that, Hollywood pointed it out to me. Mm-hmm. And a few days later, I wrote to Minkowski, and that started a long and valuable collaboration.
I see, yes,
us.
Indeed.
I also wrote to Jan Oort. Now, I pointed out three identifications, you see, NGC 5128,
right.
M87 in the Virgo cluster, and I had a very enthusiastic four-page letter back from Oort, which 3.9 pages were devoted to what he knew about the Crab Nebula, and then he made a remark at the end of it. Of course, there are a lot of galaxies in the Virgo cluster,
right.
But Oort took that up.
Yeah.
I mean, although he dismissed it as, you know, well, he had an old position for this source, which was 10 degrees away. When he went to Palomar that summer, he got the plates which showed the jet in M87.
Right.
So he followed it up, although he dismissed it.
When would that letter to Oort be? Because, in fact, I'm going to be looking through the Leiden archives,
yes.
And Oort really kept his letters in order, so
yes.
I could probably find it.
Well, it would be sometime between September and, let's see, we came back from New Zealand, June, July, August. It would be sometime around October to December of 1948.
Okay. Yes, I'm trying to find that.
I mean, maybe 2 months more. Right. I can't remember.
About then. But now, I'm still curious, did you ever actually look at photographs of this thing? Was it strictly by R.A. and Deck listed in books for all these objects?
Well, as it happens, just looking at it in Norton Star Atlas, there's a fair description of the crab. And I think both MH7 NDC 4486 and Centaurus NDC 5128 are pointed out as interesting objects in that. Now, in the case of Cygnus, of course,